Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for the first hour. I appreciate all the emails that I've been getting throughout this week, and I also appreciate all the commentary on the companies that I've been bringing on this week. It was a busy week for company updates and even some company introductions. Please, everybody, go back through some of those companies, provide me with some questions, with some feedback that I can contact those companies with, and keep the ball rolling. That being said, in this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot on this whole NERP theme that seems to be dominating the headlines. So negative interest rate policy and the potential of that coming into the U.S. Plus, we're going to dabble into a couple other investment segments as well. I'm kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer over at Bleakley Advisory Group. Also writes the Book Report website, which I will post a link to. I highly recommend checking that website out on a daily basis, where Peter breaks down economic data and some of the corresponding market moves. Peter, let's start off with the NERP. You've been writing about it a lot. It's been in the headlines. The Fed and the Fed presidents are trying to walk away from going down into a negative interest rate policy. But hey, it's not out of the question. And the markets really do dictate what the Fed does. What's your thought on the whole concept of NERP?
So the mentality of a central banker is, higher rates bad, lower rates good. If low rates are good, then even lower rates are even better. Rates at zero, the best. And you know what? If we have to go negative, even lower rates, even better. What they don't appreciate, and what we've seen since 2014, when we started to see negative interest rates in Europe, is that you cross a line where what is perceived to be accommodative policy ends up being highly restrictive. And to me, anything near zero, particularly below zero, is restrictive. Because when you think about what a negative interest rate is, it's a tax on capital. It's a central bank taxing the bank deposits that are left with the central bank. So to think that taxing capital is going to somehow be stimulative doesn't make any sense. On top of that, you have obviously the banks that are paying that tax, then therefore damages their own profitability. And also someone has to eat it. Now, it may not be the bank that eats it, but if it's not the bank that eats it, well, then you can be sure that they're passing it on to on top of a mortgage or a corporate loan or whatever. Then you also obviously kill the yield curve. You flatten it to a pancake. And that makes it even more difficult for banks to make money. So you damage bank profitability. And you look at Europe. Europe is mostly reliant on bank lending, as opposed to the U.S., which is more capital markets. But even in the U.S., you have plenty of small, medium-sized businesses that are reliant on bank loans. So any squeeze on that because of lower profit margins ends up leading to slower economic growth. And then you throw in the U.S. is highly dependent on its money market industry, which is a $4 trillion asset out there. And money market money is used to buy commercial paper. It's used to finance government repo. It's sort of the grease that smooths out the overnight lending markets, which we saw freeze up last September, and we saw what the Fed did in response. So you go to negative interest rates, you can imagine that a lot of that $4 trillion is going to leave money markets, therefore leaving a massive funding gap in all different short-term funding markets. And then what we've learned is it becomes a trap. The ECB and the BOJ can't get out of it. Sweden barely got out of it, but just by getting back to zero. And you can be sure that also it's created, particularly in Europe and Japan, well, I'll say Europe right now because Japan has been away for a while, but a massive credit bubble, particularly in sovereign bonds. So you've inflated a bubble at the same time, and it's just not a sustainable situation. And I refer to it as poison for a financial system rather than anything remotely being accommodative. So I am begging the Fed not to go there. I think that we've heard from, I think, four different Fed presidents over the past couple of days or five. We heard from Powell, who was not as emphatic as I hoped it would be, but you know, did say that he's not a believer in negative interest rates, but then he caveated it by saying for now, which I wish he didn't. I wish he would have just said this is never happening here, but he did not.
Yeah, it really makes you think that the Fed, that the U.S. will be in negative interest rates at some time. Who knows when? It's hard to put a time frame on that. But
there's no reason to go there. It's not accommodative. It's not a form of easing. It's a form of capital destruction, is what it is. And I've called it before a weapon of mass confiscation.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, you mentioned the banking system, how much damage it does to bank profitability. Do you see the banking system in the U.S.? It's arguably stronger than it was back at the last financial crisis, but does that mean the banks can weather that storm?
I think U.S. banks can because they have a lot of different levers compared to European banks, for example. They're more reliant on capital markets, and that becomes an offset. But if you do look at European bank stocks, and they're down about 80% from the peak in 2007, and Japanese bank stocks are down 90% from where they were in 1989, 90% in nominal terms from where they were 30 years ago. And now, U.S. banks, from a balance sheet perspective, I think they're fine. But from a profitability perspective, they're certainly under major pressure here, particularly now that we're going to start to see a pickup in loan loss.
So what do you think ZIRP, this zero interest rate policy that we're currently in the U.S., leads to? Do you think that this is helping to support the markets, the economy, anything?
Well, it helps to support the markets for sure. It also hurts other things. It hurts savers. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago that life insurance companies are offering less life insurance policies because they're making less money on these policies because long-term interest rates are as low as they are. So now trying to get an insurance policy, you have to pay up more. So there is no free lunch here when you have rates at zero. There's certainly, you got to pay for lunch a lot when you have negative. So anything close to zero, you do a lot of damage. And it's really right now meant to help the markets in terms of valuations, and it's helping big companies push out maturities. But it doesn't make your EBITDA grow any faster, and it doesn't necessarily help you grow your earnings, because only the economy will do that. We have a solvency problem right now, not a liquidity problem. And the Fed can only address right now a liquidity problem.
Yeah, it's an ugly situation that we are in, but it's not just the U.S., it's globally. And as you said, there are other major central banks that are in a negative interest rate policy and are having a heck of a time getting out of that negative interest rate policy. And I could argue that they're not going to be able to do it. How important is it in your eyes for the Fed to hold some sort of a higher rate policy because of the fact that there is a lot of debt denominated in U.S. dollars, and there is still the U.S. dollar, which is the world's reserve currency?
Well, I'm sure rates will stay at zero for a while. I'm just hoping that they don't go negative. I do think, though, sometime late this year or into next year, we're going to have an inflation issue. Because you have a combination of all the money that's been printed, but you are going to have demand recover over time. And I do think that the supply side of goods and services will take time to come back. And look what we're seeing in supermarkets. You see supply side shocks to different areas of food, whether it's meats or other things, whether it's trying to get a truck to deliver your product. So we are seeing supply-demand imbalances that are going to be created, I believe, and more exposed as the economy comes back. Because the economy will rebound. I'm not saying that the pace is going to be anything good at all, but it will rebound as we reopen. Just by, you look at, we went into a depression because we closed down. So it's just by nature. But we're going to have a much higher unemployment rate, and we're going to see much slower growth, but we will start rebounding. And I think that there's going to be supply side issues that are going to stay on for a while. I mean, you look at some airline flights now. The airlines have cut so much capacity that if you want to fly right now, the plane is actually kind of crowded. And you can be sure that airlines are going to take their time in bringing back capacity, as and that demand could come back quicker. Now, you may say, well, why would demand come back quicker in flying? Well, I'm not saying it's going to be quick at all. It's going to be really slow. But as long as that demand comes back quicker than airlines' ability to bring on the supply, you could see higher prices. Now, at some point, that supply can come back. But I think temporarily, in fits and starts, you're going to see supply side inflation that will impact longer term rates sometime next year. Again, and also you can assume that central banks are going to overstay their welcome on any economic recovery here with all this easing.
Yeah, that's what central banks do, though. They hang around for too long, but that's been their status quo for a while now. When it comes to the economy, we keep on getting hit with bad economic data almost day after day, but it hasn't really had the impact on the markets at all. The markets are kind of immune to it, the argument being, let's wait and see what the economic data looks like when this restart starts to pick up in a more broad fashion. Where do you stand on just the constant bad economic data, but again, markets not responding to it?
Well, I like to give the analogy that if I bang my head against the wall and I get a headache, I'm not analyzing why I got a headache. I'm more focused on how long is it going to last. So by shutting down, we gave the economy obviously more than just a headache. We shut it down and caused a depression. But that was forcibly done. So looking at the economic data as a result of that forced shutdown, which we did in order to combat and contain the virus, it's more relevant to look at what is the pace of reopening going to look like, and what will the economy, what's the economy's growth rate going to be under those circumstances. Now, that's something that's going to play out over the next couple of months, where most things will reopen. Now, the bigger things and the large gatherings, that's obviously going to be a 2021 thing, but I think that is going to be really more of a fair assessment of the economy, rather than looking at it when you bang your head against the wall.
So what do you think markets respond to the most right now? They're for the most part moving a little bit more sideways than they have been in terms of that volatility that we saw almost throughout this year. What do you think is going to be the major drivers for these markets in the near term?
Well, I think the stock market has really focused more on, and it explains the rally from 2,200 up to 2,900 plus in the S&P 500, is the market participants focused on the direction of the economy. You close down, that's bad. You reopen, that's good. And whereas the Treasury market, granted, the Fed is trying to suppress rates, but putting that aside, the Treasury market with the 10-year yield below 70 basis points, I believe, is more focused on the degree of economic improvement. And the bond market is telling you, yeah, okay, you're going to reopen, but I think that economy, and even after, is going to be really challenged, and that there's still going to be very high unemployment. There are a lot of jobs that are not going to come back. A lot of businesses, unfortunately, not going to come back. And even those that do are going to see pretty slow foot traffic for a while. I do think at some point, so I referred recently for the stock market, so I had a sort of a hall pass in the sense that as long as things were reopening, it didn't matter what the pace was as long as things were reopening. But I think at some point, and maybe it's now, or maybe it's 2 weeks or 2 months, that the stock market's going to shift its attention to, wow, this economy is really damaged. It's going to take a long time to rebound. We're going to have fits and starts here with dealing with this virus. And I can't believe that the S&P 500 is back to where it was last October when the unemployment rate was 3.5%, and things looked a lot different then compared to now.
What about the comparison of U.S. markets to other global markets? It's been a trend over the last 5-10 years that U.S. markets have outperformed almost every other market. Do you see that almost safe haven allure, and I hate to use that term for U.S. markets, creep in a bit more to investors' minds?
Well, they've already done that in piling into U.S. technology stocks and the five big cap tech names. So they've already done that. That people think that these large companies are somehow immune to this global economic collapse, to me, is complete delusion. At the end of the day, Facebook and Google, amazing companies, incredible balance sheets, but they're still advertising companies that are impacted by companies pulling back on advertising. Amazon's unbelievable, but it's still a retailer at the end of the day. And while they're selling a lot of necessities, I don't think with the unemployment rate where it is, people are buying big ticket items on Amazon. So no one is immune to what is going on. But to your question, the rally has been very narrow. They focused in on the growth areas of where there's better growth than others. But that also then leaves a lot of valuation discrepancy between the U.S. market and those overseas.
So then, Peter, when it comes to maybe different sectors that you see as benefiting, there's no doubt that some of the safe haven sectors have done well. Precious metals are doing well, or gold more specifically. Even the U.S. dollar still continuing to hold right around that 100 level. Where are you seeing opportunities in these markets?
I still remain very bullish on the metals, the precious metals, gold and silver, probably as you know. I think when you look at the dollar, and everyone likes to look at the dollar as this homogeneous thing. It's either up or down. But we know that it trades against a lot of different, and it's cross rates that matter most. And that the dollar has been in a trading range against the euro for years now. The pound, bottomed out not too long after Brexit. The yen trades pretty well against the dollar, and look at everything the BOJ is doing. The strength of the dollar has really been a bit against emerging markets that have trouble, whether that's Brazil, Argentina, Turkey. It's obviously done pretty well against the commodity currencies like the Aussie dollar, the Mexican peso, the dollar against the Canadian dollar, 140-ish. It's been what, and you'll know as well as I do that it's been trading in this 135, 145 range for years now. It's not like the dollar's broken out against it. So, I think we there's always, I always hear, oh, there's a dollar shortage, all this dollar denominated debt. No question. But, there's some emerging markets, to use that as an example, who tend to have more dollar denominated debt. In some countries, their dollar reserves that exceed the dollar denominated debt. So you can't just look at the liability side of things when you analyze this. You have to look at the asset side as well. So also to opportunities. Yeah, I because of my belief that inflation does follow from this, some of the bombed out areas of commodities, I think oil prices, when I saw negative prices for that front month future in May, I said, this is what bottoms are made of. I don't know the pace of the recovery, but I do think oil prices are trying to bottom here. I think with what we're seeing, the disruptions in supply, I think agriculture is gonna bottom out here. And I do think that looking globally, the Asian economies are going to bounce back much quicker than the rest of the world. Firstly, they're reopening first. And secondly, they are used to living under these kind of circumstances from the experience of SARS. They are fine wearing a mask. Whereas here in North America, we're not used to it. This is a new world for us. So while many people do wear masks, and I think masks are hugely important, all you still need is a contingency of people out there that aren't following that, and that then could result in more of a spread. So I think Asia markets are really attractive here as well.
All right. Well, Peter, great chatting with you. Thanks for joining us on this weekend show. Again, go check out Peter's website, The Book Report, book spelled B-O-O-C-K. Peter, have a great rest of your weekend, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. You too. I appreciate having me on.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.